Sure Shame Podcast, shining a light to the nations.
Hello, everybody. This is Bill, and this is our Torah commentary on the portion called Beha'alotcha, or When You Kindle. And of course, this is in Bamidbar, or Numbers, chapter 8, verse 1, going through chapter 12, verse 16. Now, as this portion begins, we have seen in the previous Torah portion that at the dedication of the Mishkan, that the princes of Israel, they brought all these elaborate gifts and carts and gold chargers and censers and all these different things. And as this Torah portion begins, it talks about Aaron kindling the menorah. Of course, the menorah, we spoke about this in previous Torah portions, and the kindling of the menorah specifically in Exodus 25, verse 37, chapter 27, verse 21. So we won't go into all the details of that here. But again, all of this is coming on the heels of the offerings of the priests. And so the rabbis suggest that the reason this is the beginning of this Torah portion, or the reason this follows this offerings of the princes, is because Aaron is informed that not only the offerings that these princes brought, but the lighting of the menorah is also an expression of thanks. It's also an offering, if you will, of thanks. And in fact, it has very long-reaching effects. In fact, they suggest that's why the kindling of the lights of the menorah at Hanukkah commemorates the rededication of the temple. In other words, if the offerings of the princes celebrates the dedication of the tabernacle, then it's the lighting of the menorah that acknowledges the rededication of the temple later on during the time of Hanukkah. And so, in other words, the kindling of the menorah is seen to be synonymous with the offerings of the princes in regard to offerings and expressions of thanksgiving. And so then, all of this would say that spiritual conquest or overcoming is achieved not by might nor by power, but by my spirit, says the Lord of hosts, not through wealth and these types of things, but by his spirit. Of course, the Spirit of God is synonymous with the seven-branched menorah. We see this in Revelation chapter 4, verse 5, where the seven spirits of God and the seven fires, obviously represented by the menorah. So the menorah is representative of the Spirit of God, and so the kindling of the menorah and its expression of thanksgiving is to say that you're not going to overcome spiritual issues with wealth, might, power, these things, but only by his spirit. So overcoming or spiritual conquest isn't going to be achieved by aggressive action or anything that I can muster physically or how much wealth I have or violence, but only by being a light. So in relation to that, that is to being a light and overcoming by the Spirit of God and dedicating the temple, so to speak, by the kindling of the light. It is the mission of Israel to be a light to the nations. And so, in relation to this mission, that is the light, being the light to the nations, and how that is even more important than the offering of gold and silver and this and that, the rabbis quote Isaiah in Isaiah chapter 42, verse 3, and say, "A bruised reed he will not break, and smoking flax he will not quench. He will bring forth justice for truth." In other words, what they're trying to say is that overcoming or spiritual conquest is not going to be accomplished through how much I can give in material things. It's not going to be accomplished by might or by power, but it's going to be accomplished through the agency of being a light, because a light illuminates the darkness. In fact, you could argue that the light needs the darkness in order to stand out, because if we set a menorah that is lit on the highway in broad daylight, chances are not many people really notice it. But if we take that menorah and light it and then set it on the side of the highway in the midst of the darkness, then more people notice it. It's the same light. The only difference is it's dark now. So all of this is to say, as we begin here, that the kindling of the menorah in regard to the dedication of the Mishkan is seen not only to be equivalent to the offerings of the priests as far as an expression of thanksgiving, but actually are superior or is superior to the offerings of the priests in regard to the sanctuary as an offering of thanksgiving, because the kindling of the menorah really represents the Spirit of God. And so it's not by might, it's not by power, but it's by my Spirit. And then again, in quoting Isaiah 42, verse 3, rabbis suggest that that is saying that when it says, a bruised reed he will not break, a smoking flax he will not quench, it's saying that aggressive action or violence is not how we overcome, but we overcome by being a light. Now, that particular verse in Isaiah 42 is kind of interesting because it says he will bring forth justice for truth. In Matthew chapter 12, beginning at verse 14, here's what the gospel says. Then the Pharisees went out and plotted against him, how they might destroy him. But when Yeshua knew it, he withdrew from there, and great multitudes followed him, and he healed them all. Yet he warned them not to make him known, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by Isaiah the prophet, saying, behold, my servant whom I have chosen, my beloved, in whom my soul is well pleased. I will put my Spirit upon him, and he will declare justice to the Gentiles. He will not quarrel nor cry out, nor will anyone hear his voice in the streets. A bruised reed he will not break, and smoking flax he will not quench, till he sends forth justice to victory, and in his name Gentiles would trust. And so, in other words, exactly what the rabbis say in regard to how we overcome and how one is to attain spiritual conquest. It's not through violence, it's not through aggression, but it's by being a light. And so, in quoting Isaiah 42, Matthew is basically saying the same thing of the Messiah. There are those who are plotting to destroy Yeshua, but he's not going about aggressively trying to overpower them with violent action or this, that, or the other. And Matthew even quotes that, no, the methods he's doing or employing is by telling people, don't make me known. He's not crying out. He's not quarreling with people. He's simply being a light. And so when he advanced the kingdom, it was by means of being a light in the darkness. In verse 2 of the Torah portion, it says that Aaron was to kindle the light toward the face of the menorah, and that we explain that in the Torah portion that covers Exodus chapter 25, verse 37. In other words, Aaron was to arrange the wicks on both sides of the menorah so as to face the central wick. And what this did, it was to concentrate the light toward the center. And so it had the effects of looking like it was one blaze of light. So in other words, the three branches on either side, the flame would point in toward the center branch, and as this burned, it would give the idea that there's just one light. So what we're saying here then is that man's attention should be centered on God's service. And ultimately, we see this as facing toward Messiah, the light of the world. He would be the central branch, in other words. And we should direct our focus toward him. And so why we're bringing this out is, if Messiah didn't use violence and aggression to spread his message and to advance the kingdom, if he overcome not by might nor by power, but by his Spirit, then that's exactly what we are to do. We aren't to be aggressive in the sense of being violent and try to advance the kingdom through power and through our might. But the only way it's going to happen is if we are a light, if we are led by his Spirit. That is superior to anything we can do with our wealth, with our means. Not that we shouldn't employ our means and employ what we have in expressing our thanks or using it in some way to try to advance the kingdom, but that is not superior to being led by His Spirit, because ultimately we overcome by being led by His Spirit. We overcome by the blood of the Lamb, the word of our testimony. We don't live our lives even unto death, not through our might and through our power. Okay, I hope that made sense. Now, as we get into the Torah portion, in verses 5 through 26, it talks about the consecration of the Levites. Now, because they assumed the role of substituting for the firstborn, the Levites needed to be consecrated just as the priest had to be consecrated. We read about that in Vayikra or Leviticus chapter 8. So the Levites had to follow suit because they too would be handling or actually transporting holy vessels and things pertaining to the tabernacle. In verse 6 it says, take the Levites. But that's not before they had proven themselves. Because in Egypt, at least it's taught, that in Egypt only the Levites observe the Torah. Whether or not that's true, I don't know, I wasn't there. But that is what is taught rabbinically. Because the other tribes, it says, assimilated into Egypt and worshipped idols. Now that obviously happened, because the golden calf incident is indicative of that. Ezekiel 20 brings out that they worshipped the idols of Egypt. So whether or not Levi was exempt from that, again, I'm not sure. But nevertheless, that is what is taught, that the Levites had already proven themselves. They had remained faithful to the Torah even when in Egypt. Now, it is true that in the wilderness, it's only Levi that abstained from worshiping the golden calf. So that might insinuate that the other is true. But the point was that the reason the Levites are taken and set aside in this way is because they had proven themselves to be faithful to the Creator. Now in verse 7, they were sprinkled with waters of purification, which was of course mixed with the ashes of a red cow. That was the only way to remove defilement due to contact with a dead body. That's, if you had come into contact with something corrupt like that, you had to be sprinkled, you had to be made clean. Which is interesting because in Ezekiel 36, when all the different peoples of Israel are returning from all these different nations to which they've been driven, they have to be sprinkled with waters of purification, insinuating they had come in contact with something dead, or maybe even suggesting, in a spiritual sense, had been dead. And so now they're coming back to life. They're being consecrated. In verse 7, back to the Levites now, they were to shave their entire bodies as an act of purification. And the only reason I bring this out is because there are several other instances where people shaved themselves. They had to shave their entire bodies. In fact, this is what Joseph did before he appeared before Pharaoh. And of course, the priests also shaved their bodies as an act of purification as they were consecrated unto God to work in the Mishkan. And again, the reason I'm bringing this out is because there are so many people who feel that the Bible prohibits shaving, or at least with men. And that's simply not true. There are some particular things the Bible has to say about if you have a beard, you're not to desecrate the edges of the beard. That's typically in the context of mourning the dead. But the Bible does not prohibit shaving. There are times that people had to shave, and this is one of them. So, for what that's worth, I just wanted to point that out. They also, the Levites, in an act of consecration, had to wash their clothes. Of course, if you have listened to all these Torah portions that we've done, you will remember that clothes are actually a reminder of the shame of our sin. Going back to Adam, when God clothed him in order to cover his nakedness or his shame. And so they had to wash their clothes. Of course, if we think prophetically, the bride has to make herself ready. We have to have clean robes in order to come into the wedding, etc. So the Levites had to wash their clothes. This garment that reminds us of our sin and our transgression. And so those clothes have to be cleansed. They have to be washed. In verse 10, it says that the children of Israel were to lay hands upon them, which is literally to lean upon them, this smicha. They are being distinguished by the people, just as later on Moses would distinguish Joshua by leaning on him or laying hands on him. And again, that word in Hebrew is smicha, and it denotes supporting them. So again, the children of Israel were to smicha, they were to put hands on them, to support them. They're distinguishing them from everyone else. And so this idea of ordination, if you will, through the laying on of hands is something that goes all the way back at least to the wilderness here. In verse 11, it says that they were to offer the Levites, which literally to wave the Levites. And that is to say that having been given by the Israelites to God, the Israelites lay hands on them, the Israelites are given then to God, so to speak. Now, by offering the Levites are now given back to the Israelites. In other words, they are God's servants. And as God's servants, they are to serve God's people. Now, this also formalized, this action, this consecration, formalized their assumption of the role of the firstborn. Again, the firstborn of Israel had been functioning in the role of priest. But when the firstborn of Israel forfeited that position, and how did they do that? By worshiping the golden calf, just like Reuben forfeited his position as firstborn when he defiled his father's bed. So too, the firstborn of Israel did that in worship of the golden calf, and so now the Levites have assumed that position. So this consecration ceremony made that formal. It made it official. And so the Levites become the equivalent of the firstborn. Now, if that's so, then it prompts this question. If the firstborn are redeemed in Egypt by the blood of the Lamb, if they are the ones redeemed in Egypt, and now the Levites are equivalent to those who are redeemed, is it possible that the Levites are a picture of the bride? Let me say that again. In Egypt, it's the firstborn who are redeemed, not the second and thirdborn. It's the firstborn who are redeemed by the blood of the Lamb. Now the Levites are assuming the position of the redeemed, so to speak, the firstborn. And so is it possible that the Levites represent the bride in a prophetic sense? In other words, in the wilderness you have Israel, a nation that is set apart from the Gentiles. But among Israel, you have those who are set apart from those who are set apart. And so, if that's so, if the Levites could possibly be a picture of the bride because they're set apart from those who are already set apart, the picture would be that the bride committed adultery. The covenant was broken, and then it was renewed. In other words, the firstborn worshiped the golden calf, and the two tablets of the law were broken. The covenant was broken. But then, of course, you remember Moses interceded and he had took two stones that he hewn himself, and then God wrote the words of the covenant just as on the first, back on those tablets of stone. The covenant was renewed. At this point, the Levites have assumed the position of the firstborn. So what I'm getting at is this, that the body of Messiah produces those who are equivalent to the Messiah's wife. There are those who are set apart from the ones who are set apart. I'm not of the opinion that everybody who calls himself a believer, who is part of the body, is necessarily the bride. The bride is set apart from those who are set apart. Look at what Paul writes in Ephesians chapter 5. Husbands, love your wives, just as Messiah also loved the church and gave himself for her, that he might sanctify and cleanse her with the washing of water by the word, that he might present her to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she should be holy and without blemish. And so it is my understanding and belief that this is hinting at what the bride is to be, something holy or someone holy, set apart, without any blemish, clothes washed, so to speak, consecrated, and that set apart status has to be beyond the norms of what most people think set apart is. The Levites had to attain a higher level of quote-unquote holiness. They had to be set apart even from those who were set apart. So anyway, what I'm getting at is, I guess, that the Levites, as far as I'm concerned, become a picture of the bride. You've got a nation called Israel. And among those, you had the firstborn who were to function in the role of the priest, but they forfeited that position. They gave it up. They worshiped the golden calf. The covenant was broken. But the covenant was renewed, and when renewed, you've got these Levites who are to be set apart from everybody else. They become the redeemed, if you will. And that, I believe, gives us a picture of the bride. The bride is set apart from the body. In the garden, when God made the man, actually, he didn't make him in the garden, as far as we know, he put him in the garden, but anyway, when he formed the man from the dust of the earth, he took the wife out of the body. So the Levites, once again, I'm suggesting, become a picture of the bride. They are to separate themselves from those who have been separated from the nations. In the book of Revelation, you see that there are those who are set apart from those set apart. Revelation chapter 14. These are the ones who are not defiled with women, for they are virgins. These are the ones who follow the Lamb wherever he goes. These were redeemed from among men, being first fruits to God and to the Lamb. Now, verse 19, it says that Israel tithed to the Levites so that the Levites could be free to serve God. And what this says to me is that because the Levites were to be set apart from those who were set apart, their focus had to be on ministering unto the Creator. Their focus was there. They were serving in the tabernacle. They were having to do all these things and give all their attention and energy to that. And therefore, they didn't have time to go out into the fields and grow stuff and all those kinds of things. So the people, Israel, were to tithe to the Levites so that they were free to serve God. But in serving God, they make or attain atonement for the people. So by accepting these tithes, the Levites provide atonement to Israel for the sin of the golden calf. They have assumed the position of the firstborn, so to speak, and so they are going to, in that position, attain, or through their service, provide atonement to Israel for their sin. And again, remember, the firstborn lost their birthright. Israel, in a sense, or the firstborn of Israel, lost their birthright, even as Reuben lost his birthright to Joseph. Now, verse 19, it says that they were to make atonement so that there would be no plague among them. Of course, not long after this, a plague is going to break out. But anyway, the children of Israel in Exodus 19 had been called to be a kingdom of priests. That was God's intention, that the entire nation be a kingdom of priests. Of course, the firstborn were those who had been set apart to function in this role, but they had been proven to be unworthy of this call through the actions surrounding the golden calf. And so if they had tried to approach God as the firstborn, or if you will, the priests, having committed this sin of the golden calf, then a great plague would have broken out in the entire camp because of this Egyptian influence. They had allowed this Egyptian influence, the golden calf, to infiltrate. And they had been complicit in all this. And so that would have allowed a plague to break out through the entire camp. So again, it's just to underscore the idea that the firstborn forfeited that right. They forfeited that position because of the golden calf incident. So the Levites now have assumed the role of the firstborn and are to dedicate their time and energies and focus to the Mishkan, the tabernacle, to the service of God, and with all the protocol, with all the different parameters that are set down, so that they can make atonement or attain atonement for the people, so that a plague won't break out among them. Now, in verse 24, when it came to qualifying for the priesthood, it says in verse 24, from 25 years of age. Now, is our understanding that they didn't minister in the tabernacle until they were 30 years old, and yet you're told that the qualifications began from 25 years here in verse 24. So what this is to suggest is that there was a five-year apprenticeship learning what to do. They could assist in the particular duties, but they weren't given any specific tasks until they were 30 years old. Verse 25 and 26, those who were over 50 were not to minister except to aid another Levite. Rabbinical teaching says that this would include closing the gates, assisting with the chorus, etc. But at any rate, the point is that there were certain age limits put upon the priesthood. So as a summary of what we've dealt with here in regard to the Levites, they had to be consecrated just as the priests had to be consecrated. They were set apart and set aside for a specific task to minister to and in the Mishkan. And as such, they had to be set apart from those who were set apart. And through all of this, what I see is a picture of how we have the body, but then out of the body comes the bride. Those who are set apart, those who are consecrated, those who wash their clothes, wash their robes, who make themselves ready to be able to be in this close contact with the heavenly high priest, that is the Messiah, to be a bride to the bridegroom. Beginning in chapter 9, we see the specifics concerning the so-called second Passover. Now, in verse 1, the dates that are given for chapter 9 is the first month of the second year of the Exodus. And that's interesting because in Numbers chapter 1, it dates it as being the second month of the second year of the Exodus. In other words, chapter 9 is describing something that happened 30 days before the book of Numbers actually begins. All this is to say that the Torah is not necessarily written in chronological order. Now, as this chapter begins, the people were going to keep Passover in this second year of the Exodus. Rashi writes that this is actually the only Passover that was observed during the entire 40 years in the wilderness, which is very, very interesting to me. And there is some circumstantial evidence to suggest it may be indeed true. That's very interesting because we understand that no uncircumcised one was to eat the Passover. That's according to Exodus chapter 12, verse 48. But look at Joshua chapter 5, verse 2. At that time, the Lord said to Joshua, "Make flint knives for yourselves and circumcise the sons of Israel again the second time." So Joshua made flint knives for himself and circumcised the sons of Israel at the hill of the foreskins. And this is the reason why Joshua circumcised them. All the people who came out of Egypt who were males, all the men of war, had died in the wilderness on the way, after they had come out of Egypt. For all the people who come out had been circumcised. But all the people born in the wilderness, on the way as they came out of Egypt, had not been circumcised. And then it goes on in verse 10, and it says, "Now the children of Israel camped in Gilgal, and kept the Passover on the 14th day of the month at twilight on the plains of Jericho." Here's what I'm getting at. This passage tells us that those who were born in the wilderness were uncircumcised. And because no uncircumcised one was to eat the Passover, you would think they had not eaten the Passover in the wilderness. And so there may be some validity to the notion that this Passover that is described for us in Bamidbar chapter 9 is the only Pesach that was celebrated in the wilderness. Am I going to be dogmatic about that? No, but it is very, very interesting to consider. So, that being said, the rabbis suggest that the command was not to go into effect until they entered the land. Circumcision would be considered, I think, a little bit dangerous in the wilderness. And I'm not just making that up. That's what some rabbinical sources say as well, that it would have been considered dangerous, a little bit risky. Parents of uncircumcised children weren't to partake in the Passover as well. But all of this is to say that if it's true that this Passover that's described in Numbers chapter 9 is the only one that occurred in the wilderness, well, there's just some interesting thoughts that go through my mind about that. But it seems to be verified by the fact that the children of Israel who were born in the wilderness, who didn't really come out of Egypt, weren't circumcised, therefore would have been disqualified from keeping the Passover. And apparently when they come into the land, that's when they keep their first Passover. Kind of interesting. Now, verse 5, it says that they did keep the Passover on the 14th of Aviv at dusk, which at the dusk on the 14th, actually is starting to move into the day of the 15th, and so we're getting into the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Now, it says, and here's why this is all important, that in verse 6, that there were certain men who were unclean. And because these men were unclean, for whatever reason, that they could not participate in the Passover. And so here we have the introduction of Pesach Sheni, or the second Passover, which occurs 30 days later. 1 month later, they can observe the Passover if they were disqualified in any way. There is no festival as such, but they may eat the Pesach offering, and they will eat matzah. Now, it doesn't say why these people were considered unclean. There are traditions for what they're worth, but one of them being that they were carrying the coffin of Joseph. One tradition is that they had accidentally come in contact with a corpse. Whatever it was, they were considered ceremonially unclean, therefore could not participate in the Passover, and so the Creator permits the celebration or the participation in the second Passover, eating the Pesach offering, eating matzah. Now, as a consequence of this, anyone who found themselves contaminated or anyone who's just too far away from Jerusalem could keep the Pesach Sheni. Now, considering that Pesach or Passover speaks of redemption, does this hint at a second redemption? Or let me rephrase that. If the Passover speaks of being released from Egypt and leaving the land of Egypt to begin our way toward the land of our fathers, does a Pesach Sheni, or a second Passover, a second redemption, speak of a second Exodus? Verse 14 said, in relation to the second Passover, that there was to be one statute for the homeborn and for the stranger. And that word there is ger. In other words, the ger must observe all the ordinances as it relates to Pesach and to the second Pesach. So that's important as far as I'm concerned, because what that verse says or demonstrates is that the Exodus is significant not only for the homeborn, but the Exodus is significant for the stranger as well, because Passover is tied to the idea of the Exodus. And if Passover is to be just as important to the stranger as it is to the homeborn, then that means the Exodus is to be just as important to the stranger as it is to the homeborn. In fact, Paul alludes to this in 1 Corinthians 10. He says, "Moreover, brethren," this is verses 1 and 2, "I do not want you to be unaware that all our fathers," not my fathers, "but all our fathers were under the cloud, all passed through the sea, all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea." Again, he doesn't say my fathers, he says our fathers, suggesting that these non-Jewish people are not physical descendants, but nonetheless offspring of that Exodus generation. And so again, the Exodus is synonymous with redemption. It's synonymous with the deliverance from sin. And it is synonymous with coming out, not just in a spiritual sense, but even in a literal sense. And so once again, we are suggesting or asking, if there's a second Passover, is that hinting that there's a second Exodus? And of course, there's a multitude of scripture to verify that there in fact is. So the Exodus is synonymous with redemption. And it would be argued, or could be argued, that without the Exodus of Egypt, the set apart ones, Israel, the people of God, would have dissipated and vanished. They would have continued to assimilate into Egypt. They would have continued to be oppressed by Egypt till we could argue that there would come a point in time that there would have been no Israel at all. And so the Exodus is necessary to redeem them, to save them. Now, as we proceed into the Torah portion, we see that the camp of Israel would move and would stop depending upon the movement of the cloud, that pillar of cloud, the pillar of fire. When it moved, they moved. When it rested, they rested. And in verse 15, we see that this cloud covered the Mishkan, and that was a manifestation that the Creator was in the midst of Israel. In the evening, it had the appearance of fire, thus the pillar of the cloud, the pillar of fire. And so verse 18 tells us that at the commandment of the Lord, the people journeyed. When this cloud would move, the people would move with him. When the cloud would rest, the people would rest. So it was at the commandment of the Lord that the people journeyed. They were not to act presumptuously as they journeyed. They were to wait on him. He would tell them when to move, and he would tell them when to stop. So in consideration of this, there are many who feel that they need to move. And what I mean by that, there are people who are seeing the things that are going on in our country particularly, but, you know, could be any country around the world, and they're feeling that they need to move here, or they need to go to that country, and they need to move to this country. I would just say that let's take what this Torah portion has to say into consideration, that we better not act presumptuously. We do not need to act based on our fears. We do not need to act based on our assumptions. We need to listen to him. And so if you feel that you need to move here, there, or yonder, let's make sure that it's the Lord who's telling you that, because he will indicate when it's time to move. There was no ambiguity about when they were to move. The pillar of the cloud was very obviously moving, therefore they would. And so, again, I'm just saying that there are people who think they need to move and get out of Dodge, so to speak. Well, let's make sure that we're not basing our decision on fears and assumptions. If we move, if we journey, let's make sure that it's at his command and not someone else's. Now, in chapter 10, we have particulars about silver trumpets and the breaking of the camp. In verse 2, they're told to make two silver trumpets. And, of course, what's fascinating to me about this is that they were made from a single plate of silver. But these two silver trumpets were for summoning the congregation, or for summoning the princes of the congregation. And these silver trumpets were also used to announce the movements of the camp. They were used in times of war. So these silver trumpets become very, very important. Now, some sources say that these trumpets were for Moses' exclusive use, but nonetheless, the trumpets were made so that when the people needed to be summoned, or when the leaders of the people needed to be summoned, or when the troops, so to speak, needed to be summoned, or when the camp needed to move, these silver trumpets were what were sounded, not the shofar. The silver in these trumpets represents redemption. So the movement of the camp is part of the redemptive process. You know, we were just talking about the fact that the Passover is related to redemption, because the Passover is related to the Exodus. That is the movement, the coming out. And so as the camp continued to move, it was the silver trumpets that were sounded to indicate when we were to move. And so, you know, we deduce from this that the silver representing redemption is why that was used, because the movement of the camp is part of the redemptive process, the part of the coming out and then making our way into the land. Now, the blast on one trumpet was a signal for the princes of the tribe to meet. A blast on two trumpets was the signal for the entire congregation to come and meet. The blast of the trumpets was either a tekia, which was a long, clear blast, or a teruah. And a teruah, or alarm, is a succession of these short staccato-type notes. So, the tekiah and the teruah were the two different sounds. The tekiah was sounded for the mustering of the princes of the congregation. The teruah was sounded when the four camps were to begin their journey. It was the teruah was not used for summoning the people, but for telling the people it's time to move out. These are the same sounds, of course, that are part of Yom Teruah, or Rosh Hashanah, or the Feast of Trumpets. And at the Feast of Trumpets, of course, now the shofar is blown there, of course, but at the Feast of Trumpets, you have the tekiah, followed by the teruah, and then you have another sound called shvarim, which kind of is kind of a broken, mournful type sound. And then you have the tekiah gadol, or the great tekiah, or the great blast. So the movement of the camp and the sounds blown on the trumpets are reminiscent of the sounds of the trumpet that are blown on the Feast of Trumpets. Verse 9, the trumpets were sounded when Israel went against an adversary. And it says that when this happened, that they would be remembered before the Lord and would be saved from their enemies. In other words, when they sounded the trumpets as they went to war, that the Lord would begin to act on their behalf and he would save them from their enemies. And there is evidence of this later in Scripture. You can read about in 2 Chronicles chapter 13, verses 12 through 16. Unfortunately, that particular instance is Israel is fighting against Judah. But nonetheless, you see the role of the trumpets as they went against their adversaries. Now, verse 11 tells us that it was on the 20th day of Iyar that the cloud lifted and they began to break camp, leaving Sinai to journey toward Moab. If it was the 20th of Iyar, that was only 10 days short of fulfilling an entire year at Sinai. But nevertheless, it is the 20th day of Iyar. They break camp. They're going to start moving toward Moab. And verse 17, we see that the tabernacle was taken down. Now, as I understand it, the process of breaking camp and beginning the journey kind of went like this. As soon as Judah, that camp, began to move, Aaron and his sons would begin covering the furniture in the tabernacle, the ark, the menorah, etc. Merari and Gershon, which were these two segments of the Levites, would begin dismantling the tent itself and load it on wagons. And so these two sections, Merari and Gershon, with the tent, with the bars, with all these different things loaded on the wagons, they would move out after the camp of Judah. Now the Kohathites, who were given the responsibility of transporting the furnishings, that is the Ark of the Covenant, the menorah, the Table of Shewbread, etc., they would follow after Reuben's camp. And so what you would have is Judah's camp, followed by the Gershonites and the Merarites, which would be followed by the camp of Reuben, which would be followed by the Kohathites. And then, of course, then the other camps would fall in behind. You would have Ephraim's camp coming after the Kohathites, and then you would have Dan's camp coming at the very end. So this is the way, as I understand it, the camp moved through the wilderness. Now, when the cloud rested, Judah would stop, and Merari and Gershon would begin to assemble the Mishkan. And as they're doing that, by the time the Kohathites arrived with the furniture, the tent was already set up. And all they'd have to do was just to go in and to put the furnishings in there. Of course, they would come out, and Aaron and his sons would actually uncover it and get everything set up again. And then, of course, in verse 25, it talks about the camp of Dan, which was the rear guard of the camp, which literally means the gatherer, because it was Dan's camp that was to protect the back, if you will, and to gather stragglers and anything that had been dropped. They would just gather all these things up. So it was very efficient. Now in verse 29, we have this person who's called Hovav. And Hovav is, of course, synonymous with Jethro, or the father-in-law of Moses. And Moses invites Hovav to join the nation and to be their eyes, it says. In other words, to be their guide as they journey through the wilderness. Because, of course, the wilderness that they're journeying through is Midian. By the way, not the Sinai Peninsula that you see on a map, but the Arabian Peninsula. That's where Midian was. And, of course, Jethro or Hovav was a Midianite. So Moses is asking a Midianite to be their eyes and to be a guide to help them traverse a land that he would have been familiar with. Now, this brings up an interesting point. The cloud led them. It told them when to move and when to rest. So why did Moses need a scout? The rabbinical answer to this question is that the cloud was not a guide, but an indication of when to journey and when to rest. I'm not sure how I feel about that, but let's say, just for the sake of the argument, that that's true, that the cloud told them when to move, when to stop, not so much acting as a guide. What this would imply is that though the Spirit leads us, and though the Spirit directs us, we still have a responsibility to employ wisdom. We still have a responsibility to take the things that the Spirit has taught us and that the Word has taught us and to apply them appropriately. Even when we're prompted by the Spirit to go in a direction, so to speak, we still have a responsibility to act wisely and based on what we know from His Word. Now, in verse 33, it says that they journeyed for 3 days. And actually, as I understand it anyway, from Sinai to Canaan would have only taken them 3 days. So, in other words, they journey for 3 days from coming from Mount Sinai. And that could have potentially taken them to Canaan. However, they end up in the wilderness of Paran. Now, rabbinic sources says that they traveled 3 days without rest. Again, I wasn't there, I don't know, but it's just kind of interesting that it does say that they traveled for 3 days. Anyway, the ark journeyed before them on this particular journey. And the Kohathites, of course, were to transport all these furnishings, and that would include the ark. But on this particular journey, the ark, it says, journeyed before them. And there are many reasons offered as to why this exception is made. But most of them conclude that the ark went before them for this particular journey only. However, years later, when the priests transported the ark to cross the Jordan River, it's when the priests step across or step into the water with the ark that the waters of the Jordan rolled back and the people crossed over on dry land, so to speak. Anyway, the point is that on this particular journey, the ark went before them. And perhaps the ark is going before them to inspire them to leave Sinai. You know, they've been there almost a year, and so the ark's going before them, and so they're supposed to follow the ark. They're following God, so to speak. And the cloud is leading them, is directing them to move. In fact, the cloud, it's believed, would spread over them and would actually protect them from the desert sun. And so when we come down to verse 35 and 36, we're told that when they would move, that Moses would pronounce, "Arise, O Lord, and let your enemies be scattered." And in saying this, Moses was asking for God's protection on their journey. And the ark would go before them, and that would signal that God was leading them to ultimate victory. He was going to bring them through the wilderness, and he was going to protect them. Now, that's interesting, because if they were in Arabia, they were in the Arabian Peninsula, God was protecting them from people who were their sworn enemies. Now, when the cloud would stop, when it would rest, Moses would declare, "Return, O Lord, to the myriad thousands of Israel." Now, if you have a Chumash or a Hebrew Bible that has the Hebrew text along with your English, you'll notice that these verses are set apart by two inverted nuns, the letter nun, but it's turned around. And the rabbinic sources suggest that the reason this is written this way is that this little section is actually something that's set apart in and of itself. It's its own, for lack of a better word, book. And that is, he's saying, arise, O Lord, let your enemies be scattered. Return, O Lord, to the myriad thousands of Israel. That's kind of something that is part of the narrative and yet is something unique in and of itself. And so today, if you go to a synagogue, when the ark is opened and they bring out the Torah scroll, they will recite Moses' words, arise, O Lord, and let your enemies be scattered. And when it's returned to the ark, they will recite, return, O Lord, to the myriad thousands of Israel. So at any rate, what we're trying to bring across here is that the Ark of the Covenant, in their journeying in the wilderness, at least as they leave Sinai, goes before them to inspire them. It is to be seen as God is leading them through the land of their enemies. Though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I'll fear no evil, for you are with me. Later on, that psalm says, you prepare a table for me in the presence of my enemies. And so if the Lord is with us, who can be against us? Now, that the ark went before them on this journey, I wonder if that could possibly be the inspiration for what happened later on when they're in the land in 1 Samuel 4. And that is specifically this in verse 3. And when the people had come into the camp, the elders of Israel said, why has the Lord defeated us today before the Philistines? Of course, they've just lost a battle against the Philistines. And this is in the time of Eli, the high priest, and his two sons, Hophni and Pinchas. So here's what they say. Let us bring the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord from Shiloh to us, that when it comes among us, it may save us from the hand of our enemies. So again, when the ark would go before them, it was emblematic that God was going to protect them and deliver them from their enemies. So here in 1 Samuel 4, somebody had the idea of, let's go get the Ark of the Covenant and we'll bring it into the camp and we'll go back to battle against the Philistines and we'll be saved from the hand of our enemies. Of course, it didn't turn out that way because God was not with them at that point. But anyway, in the wilderness, they had just experienced a defeat of some sorts. That is, the golden calf incident, all the ramifications of that. And so now they're going to be moving away from Sinai, and the ark is leading them to encourage them that God is going to deliver them from their enemies. Now, in chapter 11, we start to get into some chapters that things go awry. Things don't go well. And we see that as they begin to move further into the wilderness, the people are becoming a bit more frantic about provision. They left Sinai, being led by the Ark of the Covenant, and then they revert back again to the corruption that they inherited in Egypt. And ultimately, this fear, murmuring, these rebellions, are going to disqualify them from entering the land. Now in verse 1, they started to murmur, and as they're murmuring and complaining, that results in a fire breaking out at the edges of the camp. Now, rabbinic sources say that this fire that broke out in the edge of the camp was concentrated on the so-called Arav, which is translated mixed multitude. These were the people who attached themselves to Israel in the guise of being sincere converts. And yet these were the same people who were constantly a thorn in the people's side and would incite them to revolt. There are sources that suggest that it's the Arav who actually provoked the golden calf incident. At any rate, this place where this fire broke out became known as Taberah, or burning. Now, in verse 4, it says that the mixed multitude among them fell a-lusting. This rabble that was among them were starting to lust. And so, as they start to lust and grumble and complain, that influenced Israel to start grumbling and complaining. And when Israel started grumbling and complaining, they began to weep. And so, what we see is that tares among the wheat, if that's unchecked, then the tares will influence the wheat. You know, most of Scripture, as I've said many times, is not directed at the world or the tare. Most of Scripture is directed at God's people, or the wheat, to quit acting like the tares, because the tares influence the wheat. And so the Aravrav, this rabble, complain, but they influence Israel to complain. And again, Israel begins to weep. And so this discontent we see is very contagious, and it begins to spread throughout the camp. And at that point, they begin looking for a reason to complain. And they found it. They found it with those who had mixed with them. And what were they lusting after? The food of Egypt. To paraphrase this, we don't have any food. We had all this food in Egypt. Now here we don't have any food. We don't have any flocks. We don't have any herds. We don't have anything. Well, that wasn't true. They did have flocks. They did have herds. It's just that they didn't have the food that they had enjoyed in Egypt, which in our day and time would be like us lusting after Taco Bell and KFC instead of the manna that God was providing. In verse 5, they say, "We remember the fish and all this and the other, and we ate it free of charge." And so they end up longing for the food of Egypt, even preferring the slavery of Egypt to their present situation. Now, they say that in Egypt, we ate our food for free. Well, look, Egypt wouldn't give them straw to make brick. So can I believe that Egypt would give them free food? Really, what this is to say is they were complaining, "In Egypt, we ate without having to obey God's command." So really, their gripe is this: we don't want to obey God's command in order to eat. We want to do what we want to do and still be able to eat. And so we would prefer the bondage of Egypt and eat their food than to have to, from their perspective, come under the bondage of God's commandments in order to eat. That's their beef. That's their problem. And that was initiated by the Aravrav. And so in the end, Israel is willing to trade their birthright for a mess of pottage. Of course, that's reminiscent of what Esau did. Esau sold the birthright. He despised the birthright for a bowl of stew. Interestingly enough, the word Esau is synonymous with the tare, the weed, amongst the wheat. His name is associated with unfruitful grass, or the tear, and he's the one who despised the birthright. And so what I'm getting at is, at this point, Israel, Jacob, begins to act like Esau, and Esau is rejected by God. So, through all of this, again, their grumbling and complaining, their murmuring, is using the excuse of the food that they had in Egypt, but they're really arguing that we don't want to have to obey God's commands in order to eat. We want to do what we want to do. Now, God gives us what we need. He does not necessarily give us what we want. The manna was enough to satisfy their hunger, but it was not enough to satisfy their lusts. They were lusting for Egypt. And he was giving them his bread. He was giving them what they need, not what they wanted. Psalm 37 says, "I have been young and am now old, yet I have not seen the righteous forsaken or his descendants begging bread." Again, he gives us what we need, not necessarily what we want. Because what we want is not always what we need. What we want is indicative of lusting. And so they disdained the food that God gave them. And that's really important, because actually the manna represents his word. When they would go out to collect the manna every morning, except Shabbat, they would collect an omer. An omer is spelled Ayin Mem Resh. Linguistically, it is equivalent to the word amar, which is spelled Aleph Mem Resh. Omer is Ayin Mem Resh. Amar is Aleph Mem Resh. So phonetically, these two are similar. Omer is the amount of manna that they would collect. Amar is the word that means to say or to speak. And so an omer is equivalent to speaking. An omer is emblematic of the manna that they were collecting. And so the manna they were collecting was, if you will, our daily bread. Not just physical bread, but the bread that comes from heaven. And so they were disdaining the bread that came from heaven. They were disdaining his word. And they would have much preferred the food of Egypt because we didn't have to keep God's word. Now compare Israel's response to God's food to Daniel's response to Babylon's food. Daniel chapter 1 verse 8. But Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's delicacies, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore he requested of the chief of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. In other words, Israel preferred Egypt's delicacies because Egypt didn't require them to keep God's commands, but Egypt's commands. That's what they preferred. Daniel, on the other hand, doesn't want to eat Babylon's delicacies, but prefers, if I can put it this way, God's food. And in the end, Daniel looks healthier than all the others who have eaten the king's food. So, from all of this, perhaps we could deduce that not only was God wanting to bring them out from the bondage of Egypt, but out from under the mindset of Egypt. And maybe God wanted to purge Israel of everything that was Egyptian. And one of the things that we see this most prevalent in this is that he wanted them to be purged of the food of Egypt. He wanted them to detox, if you will, physically, mentally, spiritually, completely. And yet, when they started the detox, their flesh rose up. And they began to crave the things that pertain to Egypt. And so they began to murmur. And there are bad consequences of that. In fact, Paul warns our generation not to make the same mistakes that these people made when he says in 1 Corinthians 10 verse 11, "Now all these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the ages have come." So, in other words, don't be lusting after the things of Egypt. Don't find yourself in a position that you desire to have these other things that don't require you to keep God's commands. Don't find yourself in a position that you disdain your daily bread, the word that comes from the Creator. The Torah begins to compare the manna with what they were lusting after. Because they were disdaining the manna in preference to the food of Egypt, now the Torah begins to describe or compare the manna with what they were lusting after. Israel didn't have to work to gather it, first of all. It was indeed free. And in verse 8, it says that it had the taste of a cake baked with oil. Literally, it says that it was something juicy made with oil. In Exodus 16, it is said to have tasted like wafers made with honey. But the point is that the Torah portion is bringing out that the very thing they're disdaining is something they didn't have to work for. It was given freely. And yet they're trying to find ways to disdain it, to discredit it. But the Torah is going to rebut that. Now in verse 10, it said that the people gathered outside their tents and they wept publicly. They began to desire publicly to return to Egypt. And they are doubting that the Lord had spoken to Moses. And they're doubting that the Lord had been with them all this time. They're doubting all these things and they're doing it publicly. And they're making a very big show of it. And that when this happened, Moses apparently fell into despair and he just cried out to God. And this is what he says in verses 12 through 15. And I'm going to paraphrase it. "These aren't my kids. Why do I have to babysit them? I can't do this anymore alone. In fact, if this is what you're demanding of me, kill me." So, obviously, Moses is fed up. He's over it. And this particular outburst, if I can put it that way, for Moses, reminds me a lot of what Elijah prayed when he fled for his life in 1 Kings 19. In verse 4, he says this, "But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a broom tree. And he prayed that he might die and said, 'It's enough. Now, Lord, take my life, for I am no better than my fathers.'" So I tied that in because, of course, Moses and Elijah are linked together prophetically in many ways. But here they are praying the same thing, essentially. And Moses is because these people, you know, they're kids and I'm tired of babysitting them. I just can't do this anymore. So if this is how it's got to be, I'd just soon die. So, even though he's saying these aren't my kids, yet in a way they really are. They are his children because he had been a quote-unquote father to him, and therefore a father cannot shirk his duties. He can't just decide, you know what, I don't want to be a father anymore. Nevertheless, verse 16, God tells him to call 70 men of the elders. It was people that he knew, not a popularity contest, but these would be men who had proven their integrity. In verse 17, they were to bear the burdens of leadership with Moses. Bear the burdens. That's a very important statement. They are not to impose burdens because they are in leadership. They're to bear the burdens of leadership. And this is very interesting to me because actually this and other verses are principles that our system of government, our representative style of government, was based upon. The representatives, as the founding fathers saw it, were to be men of integrity, not the most popular, but men of integrity and virtue, of high character, and that the people were to elect representatives that were men that they knew their virtues and characters, and these representatives were to bear burdens, not impose burdens. In other words, our republic was founded upon biblical principles. Of course, we don't have time to get into this, and this is not the topic today, but we have strayed very, very far from that. But that principle is found right here in this Torah portion, that Moses was to find and select men that he knew. And these men were not to come to the idea that, well, now I'm leadership, that I can impose burdens on the people. No, these men were to bear burdens for the sake of the people. In verse 17, God tells Moses that he would take the same spirit that's upon him and he would place it upon them. Now, in doing that, it does not diminish the spirit that was upon Moses. But just like you would go to a candle that's burning, you could take that candle and kindle other candles. And the flame is not taken away from the original. Well, that's the same concept. The Spirit of God that was upon Moses would be taken and placed upon these other 70 men, but without diminishing the level of the Spirit of God that was upon Moses. And when this happened, they prophesied, which is a manifestation of the Spirit. Of course, that's later on in verse 25. Their presence in the camp with the Spirit upon them apparently was to served to diminish the murmurings that were going on in the camp. Now, later on in Israel's history, these 70 elders would later be called the Sanhedrin. Now, this is not a new concept here in Numbers. This is something we see way back in Exodus 3 and Exodus 4. You've got elders in Egypt. And in Exodus 24, you've got 70 elders. And that was before the Ten Commands were given. Of course, those men were apparently destroyed in verse 1 of this chapter. At any rate, the point is that this is not a new concept. This is something that has shown up in the scripture before. And I should point out that these 70, it is believed, are distinguished from the 70 judges that were appointed in Exodus 18. Of course, that was as a result of Jethro's advice. But in this chapter, the 70 elders that were to lead and or to help bear the burdens of leadership would later be called the Sanhedrin, because these 70 were to help Moses lead the nation, not necessarily judge. Now, verses 18 through 20, the Lord tells the people, since you wanted flesh, you're going to have it. In fact, you're going to have it not one day, but you're going to have it for 30 days. Until it's loathsome to you. In fact, you're going to have it until it's coming at your noses. And it's the reason for it is because you said it would have been better for us in Egypt. They're lusting for the things of Egypt. So, okay, I'm going to give you the things of Egypt till it's coming at your nose. But you're going to find out that what you want is not what you needed. Now, when God tells Moses this, Moses seems to doubt that for a bit. And so God asks Moses, is the Lord's hand too short? Are you saying that I can't do this? Now, verse 25, God places the spirit that was upon Moses, upon the elders, and they did prophesy. They didn't do it after this, according to most translations. However, this is kind of interesting. Onkelos, who gives us an Aramaic translation, renders this particular verse when it says that they did not prophesy after this. Onkelos renders it that they did not cease to prophesy after this. And that's very interesting to me, because what it amounts to is that in the wilderness, we see God placing His Spirit upon these 70 men, and they begin to prophesy, or if you will, they begin to manifest a gift of the Spirit. That's in operation in the wilderness. Now, prophecy here is not intended to mean predicting the future, but admonishing the people, encouraging the people, maybe even rebuking the people under God's authority. Now, the Torah tells us that there were two elders, Medad and Eldad, who prophesied even though they were not present with the others. In other words, they didn't necessarily have to be at the tabernacle, apparently, in order to be empowered by the Spirit. They just needed to have the heart to lead the people. Now, when this happened, it angered one young man, and some traditions have that young man as being Joshua, and he wanted to have them incarcerated. Let's put it this way. The Spirit that was on Moses comes upon these two men who didn't come to the tabernacle. This young man wants to have them put in jail. And so there's this animosity between them. I want you to consider the animosity that first emerged when the non-Jewish believers were being empowered by the Spirit of God in the book of Acts. In other words, when the Gentiles, quote-unquote, began to respond to the message of the Messiah, and when Peter, for instance, went to Cornelius' house, and the Spirit of God came upon Cornelius, and it became very obvious that God had visited the Gentiles. There was this animosity that developed between the non-Jewish believers, between the Jewish believers toward the non-Jewish believers. Now, I'm relating that to what this young man is saying of these two men who didn't come up to the tabernacle. In verse 29, here's how Moses responds to that. Would that all the Lord's people were prophets. You know, don't be jealous for me. Don't be jealous for my sake. I wish they were all prophets. And so he was desiring that God would put His Spirit on all the people. Several things that we can see in this. It demonstrates just how meek and virtuous Moses is, because he cares for all the people. But perhaps it reminds us also of an incident that occurs in the Gospels. Mark chapter 9, verse 38 through 40. Now John answered him, saying, "Teacher, we saw someone who does not follow us casting out demons in your name, and we forbade him because he does not follow us." But Yeshua said, "Do not forbid him. For no one who works a miracle in my name can soon afterward speak evil of me. For he who is not against us is on our side." So perhaps in the Torah portion, it is jealousy that prompted the young man to want to restrain this person. And obviously, it's jealousy of some sort that prompts John and these disciples who wanted to have Yeshua forbid this other person from doing something in his name. But Yeshua's response is the same as Moses' response. Hey, don't be jealous for me. Look, I would that all God's people were filled with the Spirit. I would that all people were for me. And so we see the picture of the Spirit being placed upon those, even those who were not in the tabernacle, but yet who had the heart, those who were being groomed, if you will, to be leaders. The Spirit comes upon them and they prophesy. And then there's this jealousy that arises. Well, they didn't come to the tabernacle. They shouldn't be doing this. Or they're not following us. They shouldn't be doing this. And Moses and Yeshua's response is, hey, I wish God would put His Spirit upon all people. Verse 31. A wind brings the quail, the meat, from the sea, it says. In other words, the meat that they desired, remember they had been desiring the food of Egypt, came from the direction of the sea, which means it came from the direction of Egypt. They had lusted after Egypt and its offerings, so God gave them the things of Egypt, so to speak. Again, He gave it to them not because it's what they needed, but it was because of what they wanted. And so He gave them what they wanted to teach them it's not what they needed. It's just like Israel wanted a king. They got Saul, and that didn't work out so good. So This is what the quail represents. They're coming in from the direction of the sea or from Egypt. And as they fly in, they are apparently exhausted from the long flight, because by the time they get to the camp or the edges of the camp, they weren't able to get above 2 cubits off the ground. And so that made netting them or catching them very easy. Yet, ironically, the people became ensnared in their own lusts. And so a plague is the result of this lusting. In fact, it struck them, it says, when the meat was in their teeth. They didn't even get it swallowed good when the plague broke out. And where they died was called, in English, the graves of lust. So the lusting results in death. Disdaining what God gives in deference to what you want results in death. Now, the instigators, it says, died instantly. As soon as they're eating this, the folks who instigated this murmuring, they died right then. But that everyone else who'd been led astray by these instigators, they continued to eat this quail for a month. In this, here's what we see. God demonstrates that he could easily provide for their needs. They just won't believe that. They just come short of accepting that. Now, centuries later, the psalmist in Psalm 78 says this: he caused an east wind to blow in the heavens, and by his power he brought in the south wind. He also rained meat on them like the dust, feathered fowl like the sands of the sea, and he let them fall in the midst of their camp all around their dwellings. So they ate and were well filled, for he gave them their own desire. They were not deprived of their craving. But while their food was still in their mouths, the wrath of God came against them and slew the stoutest of them and struck down the choice men of Israel. In spite of this, they still sinned and did not believe in his wondrous works. And so we glean from this that even though God was proving to them he was well able to take care of their needs, they could not overcome their lusting. And he gave them what they wanted to teach them. It's not what they needed. In fact, we also glean from this that in a time of prosperity, or if I can put it this way, having what you want, that's when judgment comes. Now in chapter 12, we see that Moses' leadership is going to be challenged. He comes under fire from those of his own household, his brother and his sister. And this is amazing to me, considering that the people had just died from lusting after flesh. Now, if this happened in chronological order, that makes it very dramatic. But nonetheless, these people had just died from lusting after flesh because they had doubted God's ability to lead them. And so in this chapter, Miriam calls into question Moses' designation as the leader of the people. Doesn't God speak to you too, Aaron, and to me? And doesn't he speak to all of the people? And how is it that Moses gets to be the supreme leader of the people? Those are my words. So Miriam is considered to be the instigator because she's the one who is struck with leprosy. And of course, she has to be removed from the camp, just as those who are dead are removed from the camp, like Nadab and Abihu. They were struck dead, and they were removed from the camp. Now, Moses' Cushite wife seems to be the focus of the controversy. Now, some people think that this is Zipporah, who was, of course, a native of Midian, and that is synonymous with the term Cusi, the Cusi of Arabia. And so from the Cusi, we get the Cushite. But now others interpret it as being an Ethiopian woman, which would mean then a second wife. Whatever the case may be, that seems to be the center of controversy. Now this is ironic that Miriam would be the instigator of this, calling Moses' leadership into question, because it was Miriam who had watched over Moses as a baby in the bulrushes. It was Miriam who had led the women in song when they had crossed the sea. But it's also Miriam who is guilty of Lashon Hora, the evil tongue. And so one of the things that occurs to me in this is how quickly we can go from being spiritually minded to carnally minded. An example of this is when the Messiah asks his disciples, "Who do people say that I am?" and then asks, "Who do you say that I am?" It's Peter that jumps up and says, "You are the Messiah and the Son of the living God." And Yeshua responds to them, "Blessed are you, Shimon Bar-Yonah, because flesh and blood didn't reveal this to you, but my Father who is in heaven." In other words, Peter was being spiritually minded. But just a few verses later, when Messiah is talking about his upcoming death, it's Peter who says, "This isn't going to happen." And then Yeshua turns to him and says, "Get behind me, Satan." In other words, Peter had gone from being spiritually minded to very quickly being carnally minded. Likewise, Miriam, someone who had been very spiritually minded, is now guilty of Lashon Hara, the evil tongue. Because in verse 2, she essentially claims equality with Moses. And in fact, that's basically the same argument that Korach is going to make in a later Torah portion. Now, the Bible tells us that the Lord heard it, and the Lord is the one who's going to vindicate Moses. I would assume from that the Lord hears what is spoken about his servants and about his people, and he takes it upon himself at times to vindicate his people when someone speaks evil of them. Because in verse 3 it says that Moses was very meek above all the men on the face of the earth, and so apparently doesn't defend himself, but God does. Now, the fact that he's meek doesn't cause him to shrink from the confrontation that he had with Pharaoh. Because meekness does not mean that you can't speak up and do what is right in God's eyes. It just means that you don't think too highly of yourself. Humility. Moses is the one who wrote the Torah. So those who wish to live according to the Torah should consider that meekness is an inherent quality of following God's instructions in the Torah. In other words, if you're going to follow the Torah and you do it with arrogance, then you're really not following the Torah. If you want to do the things that Moses wrote, then we must understand that meekness and humility is a must. As we strive to follow God, we must do so with humility. Now, verse 5, it says that God called Aaron and Miriam together to the door of the Mishkan. He called them all three, but then he calls Aaron and Miriam together, apparently out of earshot of Moses. In verses 6 through 8, he tells them, "Moses is not like other prophets. He enters the Mishkan at will, and he doesn't learn through visions or dreams, but I speak to him plainly. I speak to him face to face." In other words, Moses is worthy of God's confidence in things pertaining to leading the people. And so God speaks to him mouth to mouth or face to face. To see his similitude is something that is given to Moses. That is not to say that he saw God's face or his form, but his presence. He saw the burning bush. He was placed in the cleft of the rock and God passed by. He put his hand over him so he couldn't see his face, but he could see the backside. Anyway, he's making it very clear to Moses and Aaron that this one you're speaking of, who just happens to be your brother, is someone that I have set apart, and how dare you speak against him. So in verse 10, Miriam is struck with leprosy for her slander against Moses. The fact that Aaron is not stricken with the leprosy suggests that he's not the instigator, but he was simply drawn into the controversy. But it's Aaron, who in verse 12 pleads with Moses not to hold her guilty. Now, as a Metzorah, as one stricken with leprosy, of course, she would be considered as dead, even though she's still living. So Aaron, because of that, appeals to Moses. And though he was the object of her slander, Moses nevertheless appeals for her healing. God heeds his prayer of forgive them, but there were still consequences nevertheless. And of course, she was shut outside the camp for 7 days and then subsequently restored. So apparently, she was healed immediately, but nonetheless had to remain separated as evidence of God's rebuke. And so, technically, she had not been declared a Metzorah by the priest. And perhaps because of that, that is why she did not have to go through the normal process that we've studied about before. But in fact, she rejoined them 7 days later, and then they continued on to their journey to the wilderness of Paran. And so, interestingly enough, at the close of this Torah portion, we see that Moses, who has had to deal with the people and their murmurings and bickerings, and who in further Torah portions will have to deal with even more from the people, oddly enough, has to come under attack from his own family. And so as we try to hear from the Creator and follow his instructions, I guess it's to say that we should not be surprised when even those who we think are the closest to us sometimes are tempted to turn on us. But if anything can be gleaned from that, it's not to focus on the bad or the negative connotation of that. It's just to know that regardless of what we may go through and who may come against us, if we are walking upright before our Father, even when we can't or won't defend ourselves, He will. And so with that, we come to the conclusion of this Torah portion. Thank you for joining us. Shalom.
Like what you're hearing? Become a BillCloud Premium Partner to watch or listen to hundreds of hours of teachings and resources on demand. Go to BillCloud.com/subscribe to start watching today.